calls FDIC versus Yale Fisher. Are both parties ready? Thank you. A couple of continued housekeeping matters. Case is set for an hour, half hour per side. The petitioner has to keep track of your time. Please state your name and who you represent at the beginning of your argument. And as I said earlier, that you may see us poking around on our iPads. It's to read briefs, to check citations, and also to check any representations in the record. So with that, let's start.
May it please the court. My name is Steve Ryder. I represent the FDIC as receiver of Community Banks of Colorado, the petitioner herein. As your honors may be aware, the FDIC, as the receiver of this insolvent financial institution, has succeeded to the assets and to some of the liabilities of this institution. The FDIC considered and denied Mr. Fisher's claim in an administrative proceeding. Your honors, this case involves the Colorado Credit Statute of Frauds, or CASOF. It is our position that the trial court properly applied CASOF in this case, and that the Court of Appeals did not, and therefore the Court of Appeals' decision should be reversed. We have two arguments. First, we believe the Court of Appeals improperly created a judicial exception to the statute by allowing Mr. Fisher to proceed with his fraud claim on extrinsic evidence that would be a direct violation of CASOF's signed writing mandate. Our second argument relies on principles of contract construction, and it is the our position that the principles of contract construction can be consistently applied with the provisions of CASOF, and in this case, no extrinsic evidence will therefore be necessary. This case involves a $3.4 million construction loan that was made by Community Banks to Mr. Fisher that enabled him to build a luxury home in Cherry Hills Village.
Mr. Ryder, can I just interrupt you for a second?
Yes, sir.
Could you set the legal argument scene for me? I know you're about to talk about the facts, but I am not totally clear on what specific evidence was admitted that dealt with the implied contract of good faith and what wasn't. And if you could explain that at the trial, it would help me to understand the legal arguments that you're about to get into.
Yes, Your Honor. At the trial court level, the bank filed a pretrial motion in limine. It requested that the court preclude Mr. Fisher from testifying contrary to his signed agreement, that he did not read past the description of change in terms provision in the second change in terms agreement. And based upon that ruling, the trial court then during the trial entered a number of rulings from the bench based upon proffers made by Mr. Fisher that essentially excluded from evidence unsigned documents, testimony of witnesses. In fact, there's a rather lengthy offer of proof that was made by Mr. Fisher. It's some 250 pages long. There's dozens of documents in the offer of proof, and there was testimony of many witnesses that was not admitted at the trial. Much of that evidence had to do with the fact that Mr. Fisher claimed he did not read past this description in change term in the second CIT, and that the bank fraudulently inserted a 36% default interest rate provision in the second CIT without his knowledge. A lot of the evidence then dealt with activities during the negotiations that occurred during the workout period, and also actions taken by the bank in foreclosure. For example, Mr. Fisher wanted to argue that the bank should have forbeared further, should have loaned him additional money, should have conducted foreclosure in a different fashion than he did. All of that evidence the trial court left out. There was an issue, or several issues, where the trial court said the bank has opened the door, so to speak, as to certain evidence, and then allowed in some evidence.
But what was that?
That evidence related to comments that were made by some of the loan officers during the consideration the workout period that occurred. There was some minor evidence that came in along those lines.
Could I, just because that leads so well kind of into what seems to me the central problem, so are you in effect reading this statute as creating a sort of a parole evidence rule or something that no testimony can come in with regard to an agreement of this kind in such a trial?
That is exactly our position, Your Honor, that the statute clearly says in Section 2 that no creditor or debtor may file or maintain an action or a claim relating to a credit agreement, which is broadly defined, in excess of $25,000, unless that claim is based on a signed writing, and a writing signed by the party to be charged. Section 3 of the statute says under no circumstances may a court allow a debtor to pursue any claim or cause of action which is by implication. And so that would preclude actions based upon either the relationship of the party, such as a fiduciary relationship, or it would preclude evidence relating to the party's performance. And so the statute is very clear on its face. It's broadly written, and it disallows any evidence that's not contained within the signed writing.
Apparently, the Court of Appeals didn't think it was so clear, though, with regard to, and it seems like what they were doing was making a distinction, which I take it you are disputing, between asserting a claim and presenting parole evidence, basically, to determine the meaning of a written document. And you would find them as being, there's there being no such distinction, I take it.
Well, I think that what the Court of Appeals found was contrary and contradicted the written document. So in this case, we don't really have to go much further beyond that, because
the dispute is how that provision got in there, that 36%.
That is some of the evidence that Mr. Fisher wanted to offer at the trial. But what's important, Your Honors, about this is that the Court of Appeals said and basically agreed that extrinsic evidence could come in that is contrary to the statement that Mr. Fisher made in the second change in term agreement. Immediately above his signature, that second change in term agreement says that he, prior to signing the document, he has read and understood all of the provisions of the agreement, and he agreed to all of its terms. What Mr. Fisher argued was that he stopped reading the agreement in the change in terms paragraph, which is at the very beginning of the second change in term agreement, where the language said there would be no further or no additional changes to the agreement. And the Court of Appeals, overruling the trial court, would allow Mr. Fisher to say, I didn't read the entire agreement, and therefore I didn't notice that there was a 36% default interest rate provision contained in the second change in term agreement.
Well, wasn't the Court of Appeals explanation, though, that, and maybe this ties in with what your argument is, that they were feeling that extrinsic evidence is allowed as a matter of construction, to the extent that it's an aid to construction of the written document as to which the claim is being asserted. Whereas it seems kind of like your position is no, you may only rely on intrinsic aids in construing a contract, an agreement of this kind, because of the statute of frauds.
No, I think, Your Honor, that the Court of Appeals found that when Mr. Fisher signed the second change in terms agreement, and it contained a 36% default interest rate clause, that contradicted the first change in term agreement that did not have that 36% default interest rate clause. And that created, in the Court of Appeals decision, an ambiguity. And because of the ambiguity, the court said extrinsic evidence would be necessary to resolve that ambiguity.
And didn't it think, though, that the ambiguity was created by two apparently conflicting clauses in the written document? And the question then was extrinsic evidence as an aid to decide which of those two was intended to control in the situation.
That is true, but it's we must note that it was the second change in terms agreement being contrasted with a prior first change in term agreement that the court construed and looked at together to determine that there was an ambiguity. In other words, in the first change in terms agreement, there was a default interest rate provision, and it said that the default interest rate would be at the standard interest rate, or the normal interest rate. Then, when the second change in term agreement was signed many months later, Mr. Fisher claimed he didn't read past the language that says there will be no further changes in the change in description in terms paragraph. And then below that, there is a 36% default interest rate provision, and it's construing those two documents together that the Court of Appeals said that there's an ambiguity. Because if there were no further changes, then why is the 36% default interest rate that follows in this document? Doesn't that conflict with the previous document? So the Court of Appeals wasn't looking at just one signed document. It was looking at all the documents, and in fact it said you have to look at all the documents to construe them together.
So I was going to say one last question, just to bring this to an end. So I'm not sure where you would draw the line with regard to this sort of parole evidence effect. Do you envision a challenge under this provision to this kind of credit agreement to allow basically nothing more than authentication of the signatures and then looking at the document?
Well, in this particular case, that would be true, because the second change in term agreement was only signed by Mr. Fisher. It was not signed by the bank. And so to bring extrinsic evidence in to try to impose some duties or some violation of that agreement on the bank when it's an instrument that it didn't sign would be in violation of Kasoff's signed or writing mandate. So in this case, that would in fact be the result, because the bank did not sign the document on which he bases his fraud claim and on which he relies.
So yeah. Why is that? Why is that relevant, the fact that the bank didn't sign it?
Well,
to our analysis, I don't quite
because
get your point.
Kasoff says that in order to enforce any claim or any action, the document that the creditor or debtor relies upon has to be in writing and signed by the party to be charged, party against whom enforcement is sought. Mr. Fisher is seeking to enforce a fraud claim against the bank under these circumstances. And since the bank didn't sign that document, how can Mr. Fisher proceed? It wasn't a signed writing. And he furthermore wants to change the terms of that document by saying, I didn't read it and I didn't understand it.
Well, let me ask you a question. I think I understand your argument as well as the federal district court cases interpreting the statute. But what about the situation, let's assume, which I think he tried to argue, but let's assume in fact it was a typographical error, period. You know, in a multi-page, single-spaced, whatever it is, 20-page document that nobody reads. How do we deal with that?
I think that the signed writing would control.
That's it.
That's
so
it.
It's absolute rule would apply. There's no justice whatsoever in terms of how to interpret it. Is that?
I think that is what the statute says. Now, I will say this. Because the statute defines creditor in a specific way, generally as a financial institution, as a bank or a finance company or a savings and loan, with those institutions being highly regulated as they are today, that it would be unlikely that we would see a major typographical error in the document. But it would be our position, for example, that...
Oh gosh, you've been to a closing recently?
I'm sorry?
Have you been to a closing recently on any of your own property?
Yeah,
well, I say a fact and evidence, you just assert it doesn't exist.
but the point is, I don't think the statute allows for mutual mistake, for example. And because it says, notwithstanding any case law or statute to the contrary, no creditor or debtor can bring an action or a claim unless it's in the signed writing. And then Section 3 goes on further to say you can't imply a claim on behalf of the parties based upon performance or based upon their relationship. So I think that the statute is very clear. The obvious remedy, if there is a problem with the statute, is not to create a judicial exception based upon a ambiguity that, as the Court of Appeals did in this case, go back to the legislature and fix the statute.
Oh, wait a second. you may be right about the ambiguity in the two documents and your argument. That's, I would say, at least from my perspective, a legitimate position. But it also is a very questionable position, the absolute kind of interpretation you're taking when there is something such as a typographical error. I mean, suppose the document said, I don't know, 110%. What would you say to that? I mean, there's got to be a point where there is such a thing as mutual mistake, where we just can't literally apply statute to reach absurd results. Well, don't you think?
Your Honor, 110% would be usurious, and so that would
not be enforceable. That's right. It'd be illegal. So we'd have to say that's illegal, right? All right, we'll make it, I don't know what's the usury rate?
Well,
let's make it 1% lower than the usury rate. I mean, there has to be some sense of justice here.
Well, if there has to be, then I would suggest that must be done by the legislature in correcting the statute.
One of the statutory canons, you know, that we have to follow is if you interpret a statute, you don't want to reach absurd results, right?
That certainly is a canon of statutory construction, but the principal statute, statutory construction is that you construe all of the statute utilizing all of the words of the statute, and here it's clear that you simply cannot come in to court basing a claim for relief on something other than the signed document.
Well, let me ask you this. Let's assume we think you're right. I'm going to write an opinion here basically following the four district court opinions, which you submitted as supplemental authority, interpreting the statute. But how would you deal with a situation where there is a mutual mistake? Or what's the exception here that requires? Or is there, you're trying to argue there is no exception.
There is no exception.
Period. You don't have any suggestion.
Well, I think that there's a lot of ways that the statute could take into account a lot of the so-called parade of horribles that exist out there. You could say, for example, that mutual mistake or fraud or any other type of claim is an exception to the statute. The point is, the legislature didn't say that. And when you look at the legislative history that Mr. Fisher attached to his answer brief in this case, the legislature said there are no exceptions. That in every case, there has to be a signed writing by the party to be charged. Another important aspect.
So the court has no ability under your interpretation to take an account of fraud, outright distortion, fraud, removing the page, you know, in a multi-complex, you know, closing all the documents there, pages removed that has the 36%, gets stuck back in there. I don't know. Misleading statements by any of the officers or agents. I mean, we can't address any of that under your interpretation, right? So this is a great consumer opinion you're having us write, right? No consumer protection whatsoever in this, right?
No, I don't think that's the case, because this is a state statute, and there are federal statutes, Truth in Lending, Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, and a number of consumer protection statutes at the federal level, where this court doesn't have to say anything because they specifically preempt state law. So they would preempt the statute in this case. So there is consumer protection built into the system. It's at the federal level. State legislature here, though, said there are no exceptions. There simply aren't any exceptions to the rule. And the Consumer Protection Act, for example, has been preempted by case law. And in the case on which the trial court relied, the Premier Financial case, was a fraud case. The debtor in that case said, the bank lied to me, told me that if I gave them additional collateral, I would get a forbearance on my loan. And that was the evidence at the trial in the Premier case. The trial court said, I can't deal with that because that falls outside the statute. And the statute's language is very clear. You can come up with a lot of different examples, but the statute says what it says. I'd like to move on to our second argument, if I may, because I think we can't lose sight in this case of the fact that the Court of Appeals found an ambiguity in this case, and we would suggest that you look at the actual instrument itself to determine whether applying rules of track construction, there is an ambiguity, or there is a problem in this case. We attached the third change in terms agreement to our reply brief in this case, and so if you have that, you may want to follow along, but what the third change in terms agreement says, if you start on page 2, right above Mr. Fisher's signature, there's this language. It says, prior to signing this agreement, borrower read and understood all of the provisions of this agreement. Borrower agrees to the terms of this agreement. Further up that page above the borrower's signature is the continuing validity clause. And what it says is, except as expressly changed by this agreement, the terms of the original obligation remain unchanged and in full force and effect. So when you return to the first page of the agreement and you look at the first paragraph, it describes that existing obligation. The existing obligation was a promissory note dated May 18, 2000, in the amount of $3,420,000. Below that is the description and change of terms paragraph. In very general terms, it describes some changes to that original obligation. For example, it says that the loan has been extended and will be extended for 1 year. The interest rate is changed to a 6% interest rate. The payment schedule is changed. And then it says, which I think is consistent with the continuing validity clause, stating other than as expressly changed herein, all other terms and conditions remain the same. But to do justice to this instrument, you have to look at the express changes that are made in the instrument and where they're located. So, for example, there's a new promise to pay that exists under the description and change in terms paragraph to pay a new principal amount of $3,519,000. There's a new payment schedule, not described in the description and changes paragraph, a new payment schedule that requires 11 monthly payments of $21,000 per month and a balloon payment in May of 2003. Further down the page is this default interest clause that appears as another express change to the existing obligation. Looking at this agreement, applying rules of contract construction, such as the restatement second of contract section 203, you have to give preference to a reading of the instrument that gives effect to all the terms and conditions in the agreement and not look at this in isolation as the Court of Appeals did by pulling one clause out of the agreement and saying, hey, that clause causes a conflict because it conflicts with another document that was signed some 6 months earlier. Applying rules of contract construction, we would suggest this instrument is not ambiguous, that the default interest rate was clearly contained therein, and for Mr. Fisher to say, I didn't read it, violates and contradicts the agreement that he made right above his signature. I would like to reserve the balance of my time, if I may. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Philip Bledsoe and I'm representing Mr. Fisher in this appeal. I'd like to ask the court to step back and get to the very beginning of what we're considering here. And that's the fundamental mistake, respectfully, that the trial court made when she construed the credit agreement statute of frauds as a rule of evidence and not something that bars substantive claims. I think the legislative history that we have attached to our briefing in this case is pertinent for this court to consider, because as you look at the framework of the statute, poorly written as it might be in a couple of places, but as you look at the framework of the credit agreement statute of frauds, what it is plainly intended to do and what it does do is eliminate common law exceptions to the normal statute of frauds that would typically apply to credit agreements in the absence of a specific statute. It says you cannot imply an agreement. It says there is no claim for promissory estoppel. It says you can't imply a specific representations or warranties and that kind of thing. And we're not trying to do any of that in this case. Mr. Fisher has a signed credit agreement in this case, signed by both parties. And I might add, respectfully, the second and third change in term agreements are in fact signed by the bank.
I was going to say, isn't it?
Yeah, I believe they're both signed, Your Honor.
But don't you have a huge hurdle here in the fact that, you know, that it's plainly in this change agreement, this 36%.
Well, Your Honor,
you got a sophisticated client here. You know, he's got a $4 million loan. This isn't, you know, someone calling off the street with a language problem.
Well, I certainly agree.
He can read, can he?
He can, Your Honor. And I think the Court of Appeals found that the ambiguity is created in part because of the initial statement that all terms and conditions remain the same. And plainly, that's what it says, and that's primarily one of the basis of finding the ambiguity. Now, let me just also say that, for example, under the Second Restatement, Section 211, when you're dealing with standardized contracts, that very type of analysis is set out in that section of the restatement, where it says, in a situation where you might not, where something has been inserted unexpectedly, and that's evidence that was excluded in this case. Jennifer Taylor, the loan officer, testified in her deposition and in the offer proof. She wasn't even aware the 36% was in the contract. She wasn't even aware of it. And virtually all of the loan file in this case was excluded, where document after document, notes, writings, bank's own documents say all other conditions and terms are to remain the same. All of that evidence was excluded. Evidence was excluded pertaining to...
So what was the purpose of the admission of the evidence that was excluded? What was it?
And that's the other place I would...
Well, what was your proffer at trial?
We had an extensive proffer.
Yeah, but what was the purpose?
The purpose was to try to get the case back on the rails to understand not a rule of evidence. That only bars the claims.
That's not what I'm talking about. When you asked to admit evidence, what was the purpose of the evidence? What were you trying to prove? You're trying to prove a change in the performance, right?
In terms of performance.
That's the breach of
the covenant of good faith and fair dealing that attaches, and I believe this evidence is all relevant here. And I'll give you a classic example of that. All of the writings from the bank to Mr. Fisher, even when the loan went into default, and I might add the loan ultimately was paid in full, were written to him saying, you owe 6%. Even after he's gone into default, they're writing 6%. But the evidence that is there but was not fully admitted is that the bank at the same time is writing to the hard money lender, Western, oh, we've accrued interest at 36%. Even though Ms. Taylor didn't even know it was there. So they're lying to the person that ultimately sold the note to, or they're lying to Mr. Fisher. But that evidence certainly, I would submit, is highly probative on the issue of whether or not there has been good faith and fair dealing by this bank to this borrower. And then you have the circumstance where, because of the simultaneous foreclosure and the evidence related to that was excluded, where $7 million of asset is securing a $3.5 million loan in two separate properties, where the bank is exercising its discretion. And it has some under the loans, and in fact, it's the exercise of that discretion, whether it is in good or bad faith, that is at the core of our claim for good faith, breach of good faith and fair dealing, where a different approach was taken. But both of those are done. The note is sold to Western while they're talking to Mr. Fisher about refinancing, and guess what? His $3.7 million indebtedness with the current interest is suddenly noticed to him in a demand letter from Western at $5.5 million in that range. That's a pretty big spread. So Mr. Fisher ultimately declares bankruptcy. Now, I do point out all these loans ultimately got paid, but these assets that secured it were diminished, credit was ruined, all of those kinds of things that existed, and he had to pay more to resolve the dispute. And so in the bankruptcy proceeding, the bank's loan officer, Ms. Taylor, submits an affidavit to the United States Bankruptcy Court in California that says this 36% was heavily negotiated. That's at the record at 6455. It's Exhibit 309. That's false. We actually know it's false, in part because Mr. Fisher says that's not what happened, but we also know it's false is that the day before the hearing, Western, the hard money lender that now owns the note and is trying to enforce its security interests in the bankruptcy proceeding, has a meeting with Ms. Taylor. In preparation for the hearing the next day, it is determined that is false. And Western's not particularly happy with the person it purchased the bank from. That's at record 6459. It's Exhibit 410. They write an extensive note that says, you never told us you were telling your borrower it was only 6%. And we had to come to a different deal because of this affidavit that wasn't true at the bankruptcy court. Now, of course, Mr. Fisher doesn't know that at the bankruptcy court. All this type of evidence about how that happened and that impact of that false declaration on how he had to resolve the claim, because he ultimately paid over $5 million to resolve the claim of Western in this case. All of that was excluded.
I take it that all this information is in your offer of proof.
It is, Your Honor.
So, I mean, we can look at that, and if you win, or if they win, I guess.
Certainly, Your Honor.
So let's talk about, if you don't mind, while I appreciate that, hearing about your offer of proof, I'm really curious about your argument that somehow FDIC's interpretation of the statute in effect gives immunity to banks because it is limiting any kind of evidence once you go to trial except for the written contracts. And
I mean
that seems like an awfully broad statement to me, looking at your brief.
I think that's what they're arguing, Your Honor. I don't believe it gives them the kind of blanket immunity they're urging this court to accept. I believe that the role...
No, that's what you're saying, is that that's what it would do. Go ahead.
Their interpretation, yeah. Would, yes, I believe it would, mm-hmm. Your Honor.
Yeah.
And I believe that the purpose of the credit agreement statute of frauds is to determine whether or not there is a valid, enforceable, either way, contract that is required to be in writing. Once that is determined, once the fact of the existence of a written credit agreement signed by both parties with sufficiently definite terms to determine it's a contract, Castoff's rule is done. It's done. It's not a rule of evidence.
Oh.
It's a substantive rule.
I know that your position. I mean, the Castoff basically says, notwithstanding any statutory or case law to the contrary, no debtor or creditor may file or maintain an action or a claim relating to a credit agreement, to an agreement, unless the credit agreement is in writing and is assigned, etc.
Yes.
Now, the language that you are focusing on is may file or maintain, right?
In part, Your
Honor. Okay, and we all know what file means. Maintain seems to be, though, going forward, trying the case. It has to have some meaning somewhat different than file, or else it's just redundant. So what does maintain mean here if it doesn't mean may not try the case?
Well, Your Honor, I think the pertinent provision that I would ask the court to focus on is the unless part of that section.
Unless the credit agreement is in writing.
And which we've got a writing here, and it's signed by Mr. Fisher, and it's signed by the bank. So what that's saying is no signed writing, no claim or maintain.
Right, but that doesn't really quite answer my question, because you can't file it unless it's in writing, and you can't maintain it unless it's in writing. But what's the difference between file and maintain? And it can't be the same thing.
Your Honor,
your argument seems to suggest to me that it's limited to being able to file only. But the words are file and maintain.
Well, it says file or maintain, and Your Honor, I'll have to admit I'm not sure I know what the legislature meant by file.
Well, what's your position?
My position is that filing is initiation. The maintenance of the suit is continuing prosecution of it. And I'm reading this to simply say that unless in the course of the prosecution of your claim you can demonstrate you have a signed writing, you may not maintain the claim. Well, I've got one of those in this case. Now, if I can't maintain it, I probably shouldn't have filed it in the first place, but that's a slightly different issue. But my view of the world here is you can't start it and you can't continue it, file or maintain, unless you have a writing signed by both parties, or in this case, signed by the party to be charged against. But I've got one of those. I've got a writing in this case, and it's signed by the appropriate people. And our claim is grounded upon the fact that I have not an implied agreement, not one enforced by promise or estoppel, but one that was in writing and that was administered and conducted and handled in manifest bad faith that we were unable to demonstrate.
But all you do with your argument there is get you through the door that if it's appropriate, extrinsic evidence can be taken to examine the intent of the parties, right?
Exactly.
All right. So what's next?
Well, the
court has to make a threshold determination about whether there's ambiguity, legitimately on the face of the document.
Yes.
Right?
Yes, Your Honor. And I believe that this evidence facially was ambiguous, and the Court of Appeals finding in that regard is correct and ought to be affirmed by this court. And in part, I think you can determine that it's ambiguous by the fact that both statements are not correct. All terms and conditions remain the same is not correct when a new default interest provision is inserted. That statement's incorrect. And again, I point the court to Restatement Section 211 dealing with how to interpret standardized contracts under these circumstances.
So under that view, then, this description of change of terms is limited literally to the three lines that appear in that provision, and anything else new in this change in terms agreement, because it's not incorporated in the description, is rendered void or what?
No, it's
new promise to pay, the payment terms, everything else, including the interest after default, all the provisions that your opposing counsel walked us through.
Well, when extrinsic evidence is admitted, Your Honor, it's not because the contract is void. It's intended to enforce the intent or determine the intent of the parties and determine what is an enforceable contract. So I think that evidence that would be admitted in that circumstance would be relevant to determine whether or not it's, certainly they would be free to argue to the jury.
Well, you have to get past the judge here, though, and it just looks, and there's bold print here, interest after default. Isn't that alert you to something, right? Interest after default. I mean,
so
the rule you're urging on us is you only need to read the first two paragraphs of an agreement you sign.
No, Your Honor, I believe you need to read all of the provisions to determine whether or not there's ambiguity from within the four corners of the contract. But I'd also point out, Your Honor, that even if this contract is considered not ambiguous, this evidence of bad faith would still come into evidence. And that's what we had here. The court below said this contract's not ambiguous, but then precluded the evidence of what I think objectively has to be considered a viable jury question when you're telling the borrower 6% and you're telling the person you're selling the note to 36%. And how you handle the foreclosure and what else you're doing as part of the administration of the loan, all of that's pertinent to the issue of whether or not there has been good faith and fair dealing under the written signed contracts in this case. That's why I think the threshold question that I would urge the court to adopt.
Well, the 6% is not a default interest rate.
It was originally, Your Honor.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, typically it's not. You're right.
Right.
Typically you're not. And that's part and parcel of why that change is important and why the ambiguity is created, because this is a significant change that frankly was inserted accidentally by the bank. They changed bank software. That's how it got inserted. It hadn't had anything to do with the party's agreement. It was inserted. The loan officer testified in deposition, excluded at trial. She didn't even know it was there.
What was that bad faith, and how would that come in under your...
Well, you're right with that, because bad faith deals with their conduct and whether or not they operated on...
Right, so how would the evidence about this computer glitch...
Well, if they sold it to Western at 6%, then we probably wouldn't be here, but they sold it at 36%, generating a $2 million spread between accrued interest at 6% and accrued interest at 36%. That's the consequence of their bad faith.
isn't the thrust of the Court of Appeals opinion that this extrinsic evidence should have been allowed to determine which of these two clauses controls in the document, not whether somebody acted badly or whether there was fraud outside? Isn't the Court of Appeals opinion addressed to the question of contract construction?
Well, in part it is addressed in significant part to contract construction, but it was remanded for a new trial in consideration of the claim for good faith. And again, but if Kassoff is intended to be a rule of evidence, the legislature could have said so, could have said you can't have any evidence of it, but it's not any different than the normal statute of frauds or the so-called plural evidence rule, which isn't a rule of evidence either.
And is it enough here to find that the Court of Appeals was right and affirm them and order a new trial, that it was error to exclude this evidence, that the evidence should have been admitted to resolve an ambiguity in the contracts?
It is, Your Honor. It absolutely is. And we would urge you to affirm the Court of Appeals and remand this matter for a new trial.
Gosh, I don't want to eat up too much of your time here, but I am just, it might be helpful. We keep talking about these terms, the three changes. The terms was originally the default was 6%. We've got language then somehow in these three that says there's no changes. Yeah. And yet we've got language in the second that says the default rate changes to 36%. Could you just kind of run through that sequence?
Original contract signed by both parties, and for pertinent purposes, there are other terms, of course, but interest rates, there's actually a variable interest rate on it, but default and normal are the same. First change of terms agreement, again, I believe signed by both parties, interest rate, regular interest rate, default rate, the same. And the first CIT looks just like the second one, says all of the terms and conditions remain the same. The second extends the term as it says 6% default. Actually, I think it actually puts a fixed price in instead of a floor, which is what there was before. Says all of the terms and conditions remain the same. That's where the change, the 36%, got instituted. The third change.
Wait. So the second extension, then, there actually is the language, all conditions remain the same as had been in the first.
Yes.
But in addition to that, further down, there is a change with regard to the default to 36%.
36% got added in the second change of terms agreement and then was continued, still unknown, frankly, to both parties. In the third change of terms agreement.
And so in the third change, was there any language about the 36% or just all change, all conditions remain the same?
All conditions remain the same. No additional language, just a change in the length of the loan and the payments. I don't even remember whether the interest rate changed or not, but it had to be extended in the third. And so the change occurs here, the addition of the mistake or the change of the 36% is added in the second change of term agreement, not the third.
Counsel, can I, before you move
yes.
on, I'm still a little confused about your argument. I just want to go through it one more time. Your initial argument is that this is not an evidentiary rule at all. It's just, can you maintain a claim?
Yes.
Okay, so let's say we accept that. The second one, your ambiguity argument still confuses me, though, because I think I heard you say that it doesn't matter if we find it ambiguous here or not.
Well,
did you say that? Or do I have to agree with the Court of Appeals that there's an ambiguity here for you to continue?
I believe that it is not necessary for you to agree to the Court of Appeals for me to continue in terms of my first point, that because this is not a rule of evidence.
Right, but how about on the second? I mean, for you to continue with your claim, do we have to agree with the Court of Appeals that there's an ambiguity here?
No, you have to.
Okay.
You can believe that the evidence was improperly excluded because Kassoff was misapplied as a rule of evidence. Even if this contract is considered unambiguous, which I don't believe it is, but even if you do, there's still a covenant of good faith and fair deal.
Okay, then let me stop you then.
Right.
Okay, so we agree with you that it's not has nothing to do with evidence. It's really just a claim. But we disagree with you in the Court of Appeals ambiguity determination that we read this contract, we say, you know, actually at the top it says everything stays the same, but then it changes something, right? I mean, and that's the FDIC's argument. So let's say we agree with that. Okay, so it's not ambiguous. This this contract unambiguously adopts a 36% interest rate. Let's just assume, okay. Then how can you come back and say there was a violation of good faith and fair dealing for enforcing an unambiguous 36% interest rate? That's the jump I'm confused about.
And the situation is this. The communications in writing and orally, again, pertinent to the good faith and fair dealing claim to Mr. Fisher are 6%, 6%, 6%.
Right, but what if we disagree with you and we say this contract unambiguously imposes a 36% interest rate?
But Your Honor, the bank is still telling Mr. Fisher he owes 6%, and that affects his decision-making about whether or not to pursue any takeout financing, and in fact, that's part of the discussion.
So it's based on that, and that's the problem. That's where it starts sounding like you're maintaining a claim based on something that is contradicting the writing that you're allegedly basing your claim on.
Well, I hear what the court is concerned about, but respectfully, that the covenant of good faith and fair dealing is there. It's there. I'm not implying. I mean that contract that provision exists in all contracts, as this court has found. That's not before the court. In fact, to the extent that was ever even advanced by the bank below, they're not maintaining that position today. And so, if there is evidence that is relevant to whether or not there has been a violation of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing, we believe it is admissible, and Kassoff doesn't touch that in any way.
That's okay, irrespective of what the contract says.
Correct.
Okay, and then are you also maintaining a mutual mistake claim? I mean, that sounds different than your good faith and fair dealing claim.
Well,
your good faith and fair dealing is that whatever the contract says, they keep telling me 6%. The mutual mistake is this, oh, it gets inserted by a computer program, which, again, that doesn't seem to have anything to do with the contract. So that's why I'm trying to figure out if you're going with mutual mistake or good faith and fair dealing, or maybe both.
Well, really, it's good faith and fair dealing because by the time the suit was initiated, remember the note was sold, reformation wouldn't have been a practical remedy because it was owned by somebody else.
Exactly. So you can't bring a mutual mistake claim.
Not under the circumstances of this case. And again, that's all.
But isn't that what you should be bringing?
Well, if there hadn't been bad faith, perhaps so, Your Honor. But there was bad faith here in terms of how they dealt with Western, how they supported Western by supplying a false affidavit that the 36% was heavily negotiated. I mean, that would have been one of the provisions at that bankruptcy hearing. One of the purposes of the bankruptcy hearing was whether or not Western, the hard money lender that they sold the note to, could enforce its security interest in this real property. That claim, that request, was supported by a false affidavit signed by a bank officer. That was never withdrawn by Western or by the bank. And so, unfortunately, you know, that bad boy got closed a little bit too late under all of those circumstances. So I don't believe that a reformation or mutual mistake claim really could have been practical in this particular case. And also, because we've got bad faith. I mean, if this was a classic enforcement collection kind of claim by the bank against Mr. Fisher, then you would have had that opportunity. But the facts below really didn't allow that to occur.
Thank you.
Mr. Parcell, I want to make sure I got your ambiguity argument as to the second contract or second extension.
Yes.
Looks like on the third paragraph, it says description of change in terms. This loan has been extended from May 18th to a year. Interest rate has been changed to a fixed rate of 6%. The payment schedule has been changed from interest-only payments to principal and interest remains. All other terms and conditions remain the same. That you're hanging your hat on description of change in terms to mean that if you read a couple more paragraphs, it says interest after default in caps. That jumps to 36%.
That is our position.
Okay, and that's the inconsistency that you're making, that within the same document, which is a little different than the argument in the Court of Appeals, which is fine.
Yeah.
Well, that's your argument to admit extrinsic evidence, right?
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. Your Honor, and I do think it's important to say these these change of terms agreements don't really stand alone. They are obviously connected to the original loan document and
That may be true, but they're specifically talking about this document, which was signed by your client, which the second page says, you know, I read everything and understood.
The ambiguity was created in the second change of terms agreement because of the statement, all other terms and conditions remain the same, when that was not correct.
So we have is signed by both.
And I believe they all were, Your Honor. I don't have a hard copy of all of them with me. I believe they all were. And so, you know, again, it's not the credit agreement statute of frauds is not a statute of contract interpretation. It's not a rule of evidence. And the pertinent evidence here that does apply matters. Now, the reason that the good faith and fair dealing covenant is really the claim to focus on, and that we have focused on below, and requires a full evidentiary record, is because this written contract signed by everybody was handled in abject bad faith by this bank.
Okay, were you not able to show mutual mistake of fact and get that evidence in?
We were not able to.
That was excluded.
It was excluded. In fact, the court directed, and it's cited in one of the briefings, simply said, you know, he's agreed to the 36%. No chance to argue differently about it.
You know, the argument that it's a typo seems to be compelling when, you know, just taking out that 3 in front of 6, you'd have 6%. You know, it sure looks like it.
Well, you know, I think the evidence is they changed their computer program, their software that they use for generating their boilerplate documents, and that's when it occurred. But none of that came into evidence before the jury.
Right, none of that. So,
right.
But even you would agree, I take it here, that you could not, extrinsic evidence could not come in to add a term to the contract. And is that basically where the line you're drawing? That would change the contract. The contract has to be in writing. But you're arguing that the statute doesn't prevent you from bringing on extrinsic evidence with regard to any claim you have with regard to the enforcement of that particular agreement.
Exactly, Your Honor. And the statute's actually set up that way. If you look at 3810.124, A, where it says a credit agreement means, number one, deals with the formation of the contract itself, a contract, promise, undertaking, offer, etc., to borrow, repay, or forbear. That's number one. Number two says any amendment or cancellation or waiver or other provision. And number three says deals not with formation, but with terms. And what Section 3 says is any representation or warranty made or omissions in connection with the negotiation, execution, administration. So under all, I mean, if you look at the structure of the statute, 1 and 2 deal with formation, alteration, and Roman 3 of that section deals with the terms of the contract. You can't imply any terms. We're not trying to imply any terms. We've got a covenant of good faith that's there, that's really undisputed, that exists. Wells Fargo case decided after the enactment of Kassoff plainly establishes that it's been followed in other cases. And I might point out that the supplemental authority cited by the FDIC, I don't think speaks to the issue I've talked about, because we're not trying to change terms, we're not trying to enforce an oral forbearance or anything along those lines. I see that my time is up, Your Honor. But I'm happy to answer questions.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Chief, can I just ask a follow-up? I heard your answer to Justice Hobbs differently than what you answered my question, so I just want to clear that up. I thought you told me that you couldn't realistically bring a mutual mistake claim.
In terms of reforming the contract, yeah. I think that's right, but I think that evidence is still pertinent on the question of good faith and fair dealing, and as appropriate evidence about why that 36% is there. So I think that evidence is probative on a number of issues. I don't know how you would reform a contract between two parties, okay, one of which is not present in the courtroom.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I need to clarify, I think, a couple of issues for purposes of the record. We've heard counsel repeatedly, both at the trial court and in the Court of Appeals and in his brief to this court, suggest that this statute is not a rule of evidence, but it is a rule of substantive law. Your Honors, we've looked at that issue, and under the general statute of frauds in Colorado, there are cases going back at least 100 years saying that the statute of frauds operates as a rule of evidence, as well as a rule of substantive law. That the case in particular is Ruth versus Smith, 68 Pacific 278, and a number of cases both before and after that case have so held. And it only makes sense because if you can't bring a claim or maintain a claim, then any evidence that you would proffer would not be relevant. It wouldn't be probative to any extrinsic evidence, wouldn't be probative to the signed written document. So the statute has to operate as a rule of evidence as well as a rule of law.
Do you know, do those cases, would they just limit evidence that would go to establishing an agreement or a contract? I mean, in the statute of frauds, isn't that generally how the evidentiary overtone?
I believe that that is the case, Justice Cousins. Secondly, the second change in terms agreement was not signed by the bank. I have a hard copy here, but
Mr. Fisher
said that in his brief.
What's the date on that, Mr. Ryder?
The date is February 18, 2002. And in the answer brief, Mr. Fisher referenced on footnote 9 on page 24, admitted that the agreement was not signed by the bank. So I do need to clarify that for purposes of the record.
So what's this attachment?
Wait a second. I'm really, now I'm a little troubled by this. We have a defendant's exhibit, it looks like C-37, that I read the terms, and there are signatures on it.
That's the third change in terms agreement. In the third change in term agreement, the bank did sign that document. We attached it to our reply brief. But incorrectly, Mr. Fisher, in his brief, said none of this change in terms agreements were signed. That's not correct. The second change in term agreement was not signed. As I said, that is Exhibit F-44, and it was admitted in their brief. The third change in term agreement was signed. Getting to Justice Coates' point, the interest after default paragraph does specifically say, in the third change in terms agreement, 36% interest. So counsel's statement, I think, was not exactly correct. There is a statement of an express change to the original agreement, 36% stated in that interest after default.
In the third, did you say?
In the third. There isn't anywhere in any document throughout any of the loan agreements that says 6% is the default rate. That is a construction that the Court of Appeals made by inferring that into the second change of term agreement. They said that the second change of term agreement that says 36%, you can't use that. You have to go back to the first change in term agreement, which says only that the default interest rate is the same as the standard rate. 6% doesn't occur until the second change in term agreement. So the Court of Appeals infers that because the standard rate is now set at 6% in the second change in term agreement, that the language that comes from the first change in term agreement must apply, therefore we must infer that it's 6%. And that's how they reached the 6% figure in their opinion.
I would suggest it's giving me a headache, but let me just ask one thing. I thought the Court of Appeals very expressly said, with regard to the third change, that it said nothing about the 36%. It went back. Were they just wrong on that?
They're just wrong.
Okay.
Mr. Ryder,
hold on
a second. We need some help here. I'm looking at an agreement that maybe we've labeled incorrectly, that's dated February 18, 2002. Now, you say that's the second change?
That is the second change in terms agreement.
Okay. That's different. That says, description of change in terms. This loan has been extended from February 18th, 2002 to May 18, 2002. The interest rate has been changed to 2% over Wall Street prime rate and is subject to a floor of 6% variable interest. All other loans, forms, and conditions remain the same. And then, when you go down to interest after default, it says upon default, including failure, 36%. Right?
That is correct.
Okay. And it just has, a piece I have, just has Mr. It looks like Mr. Fisher's scribble.
period, right?
That's correct.
Now, that's the third, that's the second or third term change?
That is the second change in terms agreement.
Okay. Now, why, looking just at that agreement for a second, why aren't those terms ambiguous that we just talked about?
Well, because if you read the agreement in its entirety, it has the same language I traced through before, which is the continuing validity language. It says express changes will change this agreement. And the only way that you can get to anything other than what the default rate is, I mean, it's right there in the agreement. It's an express change to
the agreement. Where is that language, express change? I'm sorry, just, can you point it out to me?
Yes, that's in the continuing validity clause on page 2 of the agreement. It says, except as expressly changed by this agreement, the terms of the original obligation remains the same. And one of those express changes is the 36% default interest rate.
What's the relationship to the next one?
The relationship to the next one, and why we think the Court of Appeals erred, is because they then say, now the in the third change in terms agreement, the interest rate is now 6%. And so, going all the way back to the first change in terms agreement, which said that the default interest rate would be the same as the standard interest rate, that 6%, because we're now going to infer that the 6% is the default interest rate, conflicts with the language below, which is a 36% interest rate. It's taking the document and actually picking and choosing clauses from the various change in terms agreement.
When is the instrument sold to Western?
I'm sorry?
When is this instrument sold to Western?
I do not know. That was not in the record that I reviewed. I assumed that it was a part of the normal bank practice, but I can't tell you, Justice Hubbs. The other thing about this accidental software, there is evidence in the record that it was a deliberate change by the bank on certain classes of loans, including construction loans, to make a bank-wide change to the interest rate for, after default. And all of those loans became 36%. In fact, Mr. Fisher, one of his original claims was a Consumer Protection Act violation where he said, you've done this in all of these loans for all of these class of borrowers. It was the bank's intent to change the interest rate after default to 36%. It wasn't an accident. There's testimony from the bank president that it was a decision made by the bank and it applied across a full class of loans. I think, Your Honors, I see my time is up. And I appreciate your patience and attention. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions of your counsel? Thank you both for your arguments, for your briefs. The case will be submitted on the brief.